Listener support powers the coverage from WFAE that you rely on in good times and bad. As reporters and producers keep you updated on the coronavirus and its impact on the community, we hope that you'll consider a donation to WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today, something lighthearted for a change. Let's start by going back in time a bit. How about 1953?
The clown with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean. That's entertainment.
That's from a film called Bandwagon, but it really came into our consciousness in the 70s with an MGM film called That's Entertainment. It was essentially a compilation of clips from the studio's classic movie musicals.
That's entertainment.
But audiences ate it up. That's Entertainment was a major hit whose slug line proclaimed, "Boy, do we need it now." And that got us to thinking. In our present situation, what do we need more than ever? Entertainment.
That's entertainment.
To be precise, quarantainment. We're all confined to our homes, so what can we do besides watch the news or old sitcoms or soaps? Well, it turns out plenty. And the timing is fortunate because TV is in its second golden age, light years better than its first. And that is why we've invited three critics to join us so they can give us some tips on what quarantainment we should consume, including theatrical releases that have been made available to watch at home because all of the theaters are closed. Linda Holmes is a pop culture correspondent for NPR and host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. She's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, Evie Drake Starts Over, and she joins us from the confines of her home. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Alyssa Wilkinson is also with us. She is the film critic and culture reporter for Vox. She's also written for Rolling Stone, The Washington Post, and The Atlantic, to name just a few publications. And appropriately enough, she is the co-author of How to Survive the Apocalypse, Zombies, Cylons, Faith and Politics at the End of the World. And I told her before the show started that if this doesn't go well, we'll just have her read the book aloud. Thank you for being here, Alyssa. Appreciate it.
Good to be here.
Okay. And we welcome back Sean O'Connell, Managing Director for Cinema Blend and co-host of the Real Blend podcast, who appears frequently on NBC Charlotte and who is always on this program to talk about movies and such. Welcome back, Sean.
Good to be back with you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So before we talk about some of the shows and movies we might want to consume while we're hunkered down here at home, we should mention that the film industry was among the first to feel the effects of this COVID-19 pandemic. And if it all goes on too long, TV and movie viewers or goers will feel the lingering effects of this. Because this started evidently in China, the Chinese film industry, including exhibitors and movie theaters, shut down months ago. But I was surprised to discover when I was reading one of your columns, I think it was yours, Alyssa, that Hollywood began feeling the chill of this around that time. You wrote about this. Is China a big market for Hollywood?
China is a huge market for Hollywood. It's waxed and waxed over the past few years, but there are evidence in many blockbusters that you can kind of see if you go into them with a mind over the past few years to attract a larger and larger audience. And you got to figure if you're making a really huge budget action or a movie like, I don't know, maybe The Meg a couple summers ago with that giant shark, to try and attract the largest audience you possibly can. So yeah, it's a big market. And as soon as Chinese theaters close, we start to run into issues, box office, and you know, the ripple effects happen pretty quickly.
Yeah. And Sean, because U.S. movie theaters are shuttered in some cities, film producers are permitting theatrical releases to be streamed to your home now, right to your TV. Are they doing this on a regional basis? In other words, if a film is set to come out and New York is shuttered and people can't go see it, New Yorkers can see it at home, or can anybody anywhere see it?
Anyone, anywhere. Streaming is opening up to just about any audience. And right now, only one film that was supposed to come to theaters is going to streaming without going to theatrical, and that's Trolls World Tour. Universal made the decision to do this, which I know is great.
Maybe a good decision.
Yeah. But, you know, if you're a parent and you're stuck at home with little ones and you're looking for some type of alternative, it's great to hear that that's coming. But Universal really stirred the pot when they did that, because it violated an agreement they had in place with a group called NATO. And it's not the NATO that you're thinking of. It's the National Association of Theater Owners, who have this longstanding agreement that, you know, studio features go to theaters first. And
right.
Yes, these are very difficult times, very different times. And we're figuring out the rules as we go forward. But this is why, like, on a daily basis, we're hearing about major studios that are pushing their films back further. And so instead, you're seeing the window shrink from when a film was in theaters. Like, Disney Pixar are going to put Onward on their Disney Plus service. And some families might have thought, you know, oh, it was just in theaters. Well, it was. They're shrinking that window and letting those things come to streaming services much quicker.
But if you are a movie studio or a movie theater operation in a state that hasn't been affected by this outbreak terribly, aren't you eating into ticket sales in those markets? Is that a wise thing to do?
You're absolutely sacrificing those ticket sales, but I'm pretty sure most of the major, well, I think that the three major chains, which are AMC, Regal, and Cinemark, they've all closed all their locations. I know that there have been some headlines that some drive-ins are still open for business because you can stay in the safety of your car and watch something that's in theaters. But the thing I'm most curious about is when the movie theaters open up again, what product is going to be available to them? Is there a studio that's going to put one of these delayed movies out immediately? Or are they going to be cautious that people aren't going to rush right back and be hesitant to, you know, to support something as communal as going to the movie theaters? Or when they open, is it going to be Invisible Man and Bloodshot? You know, things that were there in January and February, they're still going to be there.
Yeah. Linda, as the impact of this becomes wider and wider, and some of these, as Sean just pointed out, some of these films are being released to streaming. Not every studio is doing that. Some films are being held back, some as long as almost a year in terms of this. Will that push films that were scheduled for release, say, in December of this year into 2021? Or will we have a glut of movies at theaters when this thing is all over?
Right. I think that's the exact right question. I think the question is, what's the mix of things that will, like, how far out that delay goes? Does that delay go only until theaters open, at which point, just like we were just talking about, things will be essentially normal? Or is there going to ultimately be a hole in the availability of new films? There are certainly things that have already been pushed a good way forward. Like they took the James Bond movie and it's been pushed a good way forward. You know, they're pushing the In the Heights movie, which is the adaptation of the Lin-Manuel Miranda musical. They're pushing those things, kind of some of them a good distance and some of them kind of indefinite at this point. But I think it's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. And I don't know to what degree you just get a lag and to what degree you get, as you said, a glut.
Of course, that glut might be, if there is a glut, that might be helped a little bit by the fact that most movie and television production has completely shut down. I think there are two shows that are being taped without a live audience, the two Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune shows that are on television every day, but they're being done without a live audience. But if they've shut down all this production, does that mean when this is over and we're eating through product on TV that there won't be anything new for several months to watch?
Right. I mean, I think that's the question, right? The question is, what's the mix of things, of the things that have shut down, what's the mix of things that will just be delayed and then will eventually come out? And what's the mix of things that just will never happen? Like for example, if you think about television, the remainder of a lot of television seasons is just going to not happen, right? They'll pick up again, assuming it's a continuing show. A lot of them will pick up again, hopefully with their fall season, but it's not like that's a pushed forward kind of thing. And there are undoubtedly films that have stopped production, you know, some are ones that will eventually pick up production and go forward. Other ones that are in maybe an earlier stage may just be scrapped and never happen. And I think it's one of those things where it's just very hard to tell what that mix is going to be until it happens. And it'll depend enormously on, you know, are we talking about weeks or months or what until production can resume and until releases can resume.
Everybody, Sean, knows about these streaming platforms like Hulu and Netflix and Amazon and Sling and Roku. They've all been around for a while. There are probably other, I know there are others that I've left off the list, but this tragedy essentially is coming along at a time when lots of new streaming platforms are coming online. I think you just mentioned Disney. Disney Plus is online. There are a couple of others. NBC just, I think, started one. Is this going to help establish these streaming services?
It could. The thing about the streaming services is it all depends on what they offer. You have to have something unique to bring a subscriber over. There's one that's going to be coming soon called HBO Max, which is going to offer just about everything that HBO has to offer, but it dips into the Warner Brothers catalog as well, too. They were all these streaming services were jockeying for position in terms of what type of exclusives they could get, and they were trying to partner with professionals. Apple TV was trying to sign on unique creators. And I think that race is still going to be happening, but this halt on production really speaks to, you know, what they were going to be able to complete and offer. What it might do is just open up more back catalog. So someone like HBO Max can turn around and say, look at all of these amazing existing shows that we can offer you on a streaming service that, you know, or someone like NBC has one that's called, I think it's called The Peacock, which is a horribly named streaming service.
But why is that horribly named? That's their logo.
I know it's their logo, sure. But who's going to sit down and say, like, hey, did you subscribe to Peacock? It's just unusual. But they would have a vast library that they, too, could open up, you know, and offer to people who are stuck at home. Because I think what most people are doing now, I saw a graphic that was really funny to me, which was three doors. And the first door was like brand new TV show that everyone recommends. The second one was like, you know, critically acclaimed new show. And the third one was like comfort food or comfort show that I've watched a bazillion times. And everybody's, you know, barreling through door number three. You're just going back and revisiting these series that you are wildly familiar with, something like The Office or Cheers or something. And I think those streaming services will benefit from those.
So speaking of strange streaming service names, Alyssa, you mentioned a couple of new platforms to our producers that I had never heard of. One is called Canopy with a K, Criterion, and Shudder, S-H-U-D-D-E-R, to name a few. What kind of content do they have?
Well, so Canopy actually is available through library systems, academic and public library systems, to a whole lot of cardholders who have no idea they have access. And it has a huge, huge array of films. It has, for instance, the entire A24 catalog. So, you know, films like Eighth Grade are on there. They also have lots and lots of documentaries, lots and lots of recent and classic films. And not everybody has access because not everyone's library system buys into it, but I believe there's a couple thousand across the U.S. So it's worth people going to the site and just seeing if they have access. You can stream it to your TV or your laptop or your mobile device, whatever. That's pretty great. The Criterion channel is an outgrowth of the Criterion Collection, which puts out sort of the definitive, you know, DVD and Blu-rays of great masterworks of cinema. Sometimes it's movies that came out last year, like Parasite coming out on a Criterion Collection. But the collection then spawns this channel, which will stream a selection of about 2,000 titles from their collection. And there's, again, it's like old movies, new movies, lots of really interesting special features. So you might go watch, you know, Jacques Tati's Playtime, and then you can go see Patton Oswalt talk about why he loves this movie. So it's a very interesting collection that they have
there.
Let me
stop you there. We have to take a break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about quarantainment, things you can do on television, watch on TV, from movies to TV shows, new and old, with Linda Holm. She's the pop culture correspondent for NPR and the host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Sean O'Connell joins us. He's the managing director for Cinema Blend and co-host of The Real Blend podcast. And Alyssa Wilkinson is a film critic and culture reporter for Vox. You were just talking about all these new streaming services, Alyssa, and we've mentioned some others as well, some big names and some medium-sized names. How do people get these? I mean, there are a lot of people listening who may not have ever streamed anything, but right now they'd like to. So how do they get them? If you don't have a smart TV that gets, say, Shudder, how would you get it?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, the easiest way is just, you know, once you've signed up, you can watch it on your computer or your tablet. If you want to watch it on your TV, you might have to do a little Googling because different TVs, operate in different ways. But, you know, if you have an Apple TV, usually you can get a channel for these different things, or sometimes a device like a Roku, which is like a little box that you plug into your computer and it hooks up to your internet, or sorry, you plug it into your TV, hooks up to your internet, and then you can access all kinds of different channels. So, I mean, most people have maybe a little more familiarity with Netflix, and there's not much difference between Netflix and most of these different services. But sometimes it takes a little bit of ingenuity and maybe, you know, Googling for an answer to some of the more niche sites.
So most of you sent us listings of the shows that you're recommending that people spend some time with during this quarantine or this stay-at-home period. But before we get to the specifics of those lists, I'm just curious about network television, because not many of the shows on these lists are on network TV. Is there anything in your minds on ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, AMC, Paramount, FX, etc., worth watching? Linda.
I mean, I definitely think if you want to stick with broadcast networks, so not like FX or AMC, but just the main broadcast networks, I definitely put on my list Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is...
Right, we'll talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are things that are worth watching. They, it's true that there has been a little bit of a talent drain out of network TV. As some of the people, Kenya Barris is one, Shonda Rhimes is another one. Shonda Rhimes created Scandal and Grey's Anatomy. Kenya Barris created Blackish. Some of those folks have been snapped up by streaming services with contracts. There's also an issue of, streaming gives you more of a freedom in the structure of your show. You don't have to write around commercial breaks.
Right.
And a lot of creative people really like and prefer that. So so there has definitely been some movement away from broadcast. But yes, absolutely. They just wrapped up the comedy The Good Place on broadcast, which was absolutely one of my favorite shows of the last several years and could hold its own with anything on cable or streaming. So, and that was an NBC show. So, yeah, it still exists. There's definitely been movement away from broadcast though.
So Sean, I looked through your list and there were only three shows currently on network television or basic cable that I could find that you were recommending. And one of those recommendations is Better Call Saul. It's on AMC. It's a spinoff from Breaking Bad. And I want you to explain this show to me, because I loved Breaking Bad and I tried to get into Better Call Saul and just couldn't do it. Tell me why it's on your list.
Well, then you're the perfect person that I'm trying to reach with this recommendation, Mike, because I do understand that the show started slower than most people anticipated. And I think that's largely because the creators of the show didn't know what they wanted to be when they started. And they found their way through it over the course of the first two seasons. And I personally dislike when people recommend something like that to me, where they're like, the show is phenomenal, but you got to get to season four before it takes off. Who wants to commit to that? But when I tell you that the character of Jimmy McGill, who eventually becomes Saul Goodman, you have to go through that, the learning process of who he is as a character through the first two seasons. Then when you get to season three, and again, I'm sort of contradicting myself by saying this, it reaches the level of Breaking Bad type storytelling. But along the way, and all that work is being done by these side characters that are going to lead to who Saul Goodman becomes. They are developed in a way that when the story really does kick in, you care more about these characters, and the groundwork has been put in. There's some amazing work being done by the entire cast, but I want to single out Michael McKean, who plays Jimmy's brother Chuck in the early going, the first two seasons.
Yeah,
I'm telling you, Mike, you have to stay with it, because now it's in season five and it really has become a parallel to Breaking Bad. It's as good as that show. And it's not even like the first two seasons are bad. It just gets so much better in seasons three, four.
It's a lot of backstory. It's a lot of exposition about who he was in Breaking Bad, because it's a prequel. So you mentioned, Linda, just a moment ago, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which I want to talk about. And you've also put on your list America's Next Top Model. Let's start there. You're an NPR. You are an NPR person. I was going to ask if America's Top Model was your guilty pleasure, because I have a few guilty pleasures myself. But then I read what you wrote about it. You wrote, "I hesitate to recommend it because it is not good, but what I can promise is very low stakes." Explain
that. It's true. Look, I wouldn't say guilty, because I try not to feel guilty about the things that I watch, because I watch a good mix of things. But I will say, America's Next Top Model is a show that, for me, when you talk about comfort food, I have seen most of the seasons. So usually I'm watching something I've already watched. You get a lot of people trying to figure out like how to look good in a picture. And even if you can't relate to anything else that happens, I will tell you right now, look, your listeners can know this, I'm not on video right now talking to you guys. You know why? Because it's early in the morning and I did not want to, you know, you worry about how you look in pictures. Who can't relate to that? And most of the people on America's Next Top Model are never going to be famous models. And so all you really get is people trying to figure out how to smile properly. There is fighting, but it tends to be pretty low stakes. They've never launched. It's not like Project Runway, where some of those designers have actually become hugely famous. They've never really launched a top model. So it's mostly just a bunch of people scrapping to win a reality show. And to me, the stakes are very low, and I find it very comforting.
So it's wannabe cover girls living together in a house and then going out to, on photo shoots between catfights as they vie for a modeling contract. That's pretty much it, right?
I mean, yeah, I dislike the word cat fights, but sure. Okay.
At the Brooklyn Nine-Nine started on, I think it started on Fox and then moved to NBC, and it stars Andy Samberg from SNL.
Yep.
What is it about, and what is it about that show that helped it onto your list?
Well, Brooklyn Nine-Nine is kind of a workplace cop show. So if you think about like Barney Miller and stuff like that, it's really a police station show. When it first started, I think one of the questions was, can you really have a comedy? Like, how was it going to work to have a comedy where they were like investigating murders? And they're just very good at working around the fact that crime is very serious, but the cop show is very good. It has maybe my favorite ensemble cast in a comedy in a very long time. Andy Samberg, but also, you know, Andre Brower, who's so funny, and, you know, Melissa Fumero, and it's just got an incredibly strong cast. It's so well written, and it's just a profound pleasure for me, and maybe the most rewatchable thing on my list. I have watched a lot of those episodes a number of times, and they still bring me great joy.
Alyssa, I was looking through your list, and there's nothing on network television on your list. Is that an oversight? Or a comment?
No. So as a film critic, I get to watch less TV overall than I would hope. Right. But I do think, one show I put on my list was Cheers, which was originally aired on network television. But now it's on Netflix, which I teach college students. And for most of them, Netflix is their network television. So it's just something they always have around. Right. But Linda mentioning Brooklyn Nine-Nine reminded me that one of my favorite shows is Restore, which is on NBC, which is another...
You broke up. It's what?
It's
what's the show?
Superstore.
Okay.
Superstore, which is on NBC. It's sort of like if The Office was in a Walmart. It's great. And it's on its fifth season. So that's one that I really love, and that's on NBC.
Well, both, interestingly enough, both you and Linda had Cheers on the list, which aired a long time ago, 9 years on NBC from 1982 to 1993. And today, as you said, it's on other streaming services, including Netflix. So since you both like it, and it's both on both of your lists, is the show better with Shelley Long or Kirstie Alley? Linda.
It's better with Shelley Long, mostly because the longer Kirstie Alley was on that show, the more they kind of humiliated her character in a way that to me was unpleasant. But the early years of that show in particular hold up incredibly well. It's dated. I was saying on Twitter the other day, it's mostly dated because of the outfits and the hair, but a lot of the humor holds up incredibly well. Again, the performances are wonderful and the ensemble is wonderful.
You can chime in on that too, Alyssa, but better with the coach or Woody Harrelson?
Oh, man. I kind of am split between them. I find Woody to be so endearing, and it's kind of fun to see him and then remember that what kind of a career this guy would go on to have.
Yeah.
But obviously the coach I love very much. Yeah, and I'm definitely pro Shelley Long. I agree with Linda on that point too.
So both, most of your picks, Sean, are on streaming or premium channels, and one of the shows that you're recommending is one of my favorites at the moment, and I just watched an episode last night. I think it's the latest episode of Westworld, which was just astoundingly good. Is this a show, though, that you can pick up in season two, or do you have to go back and start with season one?
Oh, even if you start it, first episode of season one, you'll still be lost trying to figure your way through it. Unfortunately, I can't imagine jumping on midstream. No, it's absolutely a continuation from the very beginning to where it is now. And it's been somewhat fascinating. I'm super late to it. I think Alyssa was the one who said, as a movie critic, you don't watch a lot of television.
Right.
So you have a list of shows that everyone keeps saying to you over the years, oh, you have to watch so-and-so. And you put it off. This has been an ideal time to catch up on The Leftovers and Westworld and shows like this, because I can commit to the time. And so, but Westworld, even in season three, Mike, it's so different than the type of show that it was. And
yeah.
So I'm intrigued to see where they go with it. I don't know yet if I like it. I'm going to let it play out and see where they're taking us. But it's a wildly different ride than it was the first two seasons.
Yeah.
And I know some people are complaining about that, but
we have two movie critics here. And I kind of think that shows like this and many others that we'll talk about on television are as good as or better than film, particularly now that Hollywood has focused everything at 12-year-old boys, like all these comic characters. Isn't television giving Hollywood a run for its money, even though television is Hollywood?
Well, it's a migration
yeah.
of talent going from, you know, people who used to be primarily film actors are
right.
finding ideal roles on cable television shows. I mean, if you just look at, as an example, Big Little Lies, that cast is unbelievably great. And it's
yes.
all A-listers. It's Meryl Streep, Nicole Kidman, Reese Witherspoon, Shailene Woodley. Fantastic actors who are now finding better stories in long form.
I don't know whether it was Alyssa or Linda. Go ahead.
It's Alyssa. I think
okay.
You know, one thing we have to remember is that the difference between film and TV has never, well, at least of late in the past few decades, has never been quality. It's just sort of the difference in the type of storytelling you're doing. I mean, film is still a primarily visual medium, and I think TV tends to be driven more by narrative, even though there's visually stunning TV and there's obviously a lot of very narratively driven film. So it's not, I don't think, a matter of quality so much as the kinds of things that you are able to do as a creator. I mean, you have more time with characters, right? In a TV show. And I also, you know, as a film critic, tend to think of the MCU movies as being better if you think of them as one long TV series. You know, Avengers Endgame was a very good TV finale. So that's been, you know, just a kind of a different orientation too, I think.
There's another HBO show on your list, Linda, another one that I love, Succession. You'd have to get it on demand because it's in between seasons right now, but it's essentially the story of the Rupert Murdoch Fox News empire family, although it's the lead character's name is Logan Roy, and it's about him and his four children as they fight for who's going to take over the company because he's elderly. What is most interesting to me about this is the characters and the way they react and the dialogue that is either written for them or ad-libbed. I don't know how actors play the dialogue that they are given. It's amazingly good. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think that is a show where I think you'd find most of it is what's written for them. But I think the great thing about that show, I don't typically get really into shows that you would think of as sort of get a load of these jerks. Like, that's not typically my favorite kind of thing. And these are all very unpleasant people, these characters. There are none of them that you can really point to and say, you know, this is a fundamentally good person. They're all pretty right. immoral, and or at best amoral. At best, they're weak. But there is something about this show and the humor of it and the tone and attitude of it that made me able to really take great pleasure in watching it and admire it enormously, even though I just dislike all of the people so much. And that's pretty rare for me. So that's it stands out for me partly for that reason.
And Alyssa, you chose yet another HBO show, also a show that's already aired. You'd have to get it on demand, a miniseries called Chernobyl. It won a bunch of awards in the past year. It's practically a documentary, but it's not. It's a scripted drama, and it is riveting.
It is. It's, you know, I was kind of glad it was only five episodes because it was so riveting that I was kind of tense at the end of every episode. But, you know, I started watching it right about when all of the pandemic stuff started hitting stateside. And it's really, really good at thinking about how governments around the world try to hide things that are happening from citizens and about how many effects there are on people. So I know some people go to entertainment to just, like, disappear and escape. But some people, when they're stressed out, they want to watch something that helps them kind of understand the world they're living in. And Chernobyl is just about the best version of this I can possibly imagine, with a really, really good lead performance from Jared Harris.
Yes, he's amazing, amazingly good. When we come back, I want to wrap up our flirtation with HBO with a couple of shows that you've recommended, Sean, and one of which you've already mentioned, and that was The Leftovers. And then we're going to move on to things that you might see on basic cable that some people have recommended here. We're here with Sean O'Connell from Cinema Blend, Alyssa Wilkinson from Vox, and Linda Holmes from NPR. And we're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about movies and television, mostly television so far. Quarantainment is what we're talking about as you stay at home. Linda Holmes is with us, the host of the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR and NPR's Pop Culture Correspondent. Alyssa Wilkinson is the film critic and culture reporter for Vox, and Sean McConnell is managing director of Cinema Blend and co-host of Real Blend podcast. I'm going to have to rethink your appearances on this program because another of your recommended series, Sean, is one that I also had trouble getting into and lost interest in and went away. And that's The Leftovers. I was not left over. I just moved on. So tell me why it's on your list.
Mainly because almost everybody I trust told me I had to watch it. You
okay.
know, and one person in particular called it the top five TV shows of all time.
Wow.
But again, it's one of those ones where season one was based off of an existing book. And in season two and three, they were able to distance themselves from the book and build on the world. And so we're in the middle of season two right now. And it is a completely different show than what it was in the beginning. But it's funny, Mike, as a movie critic, you're trained to analyze the story that you're given in a roughly 2-hour window. So you can know if it worked from start to finish in a very short amount of time. With these TV shows, and I like to invest the time in something that's more long form, that's dedicated to telling a decent story, as opposed to sort of, you know, junk food television that you can just keep on in the background. I want to stay engaged, but with these shows, it's hard to judge how it's doing until the entire season has played itself out. So what you do is you sort of appreciate little things in the show. And for Leftovers, while there's big story being told, I just love the performances. It's a lot of amazing character actors, such as Anne Dowd, Amy Brenneman, Justin Theroux ends up being really great as the lead. Carrie Coon is unbelievable. Scott Glenn shows up for a few episodes here and there. And it's just, it's riveting television when you can invest in their performances while you wait to see where it goes. Now, that first season is, you know, the term is grief porn, essentially. It's just some of the most depressing material that you can get through. But once you invest in the characters, I'm willing to see where they're going. And season two is a swing in a wildly different direction. And so I'm curious to see where it's Damon Lindelof, who's done things like Watchmen and Lost, obviously. So there's a mystery box element to it, but I'm compelled to see where it goes.
I want to move away from HBO, but none of you mentioned Barry, which is, I think, a wonderful comedy about a hitman trying to become an actor. Here's one that you did mention, and I'm not sure how to talk about it. It's a Canadian comedy that airs on Netflix in its sixth season right now from the brilliant mind of Eugene Levy, and it's called Schitt's Creek. Let me spell that, S-C-H-I-T-T, and that's just the beginning of the joke. Linda, this is on your list. This is about a formerly rich family fallen on hard times, and they're forced to live in a town that they once bought as a joke.
Yes. So I'm so glad that you mentioned this. This is when you talk about shows that people have told you over and over that you have to watch and you just haven't gotten around to it. This was mine. Everyone that I respect, almost everyone that I respect the most, loved this show and was super into it. I had just never gotten around to it. I'd watched a couple episodes. It hadn't quite been my thing. But this is an example of a show that over the course of, it's about to finish its run. It's been six, like 13 episode seasons. Over the course of its run, it goes from being a kind of an arch, cringy comedy about, again, about people who are pretty awful, to a really warm, still really funny, but very warm. It's so, I hate to say this because it sounds like a stereotype, but it's so Canadian. It has this like sort of gentle, chill, but really funny vibe. And it kind of goes from being about these very rich people who feel sorry for themselves because they have to live in this small town to a place where they really, to a story where they really make themselves allies and friends of the people who live in this town. There are a couple of really satisfying romantic relationships that play out with their two kids. It is such a good show. And I honestly am so happy that that I took the time during this kind of weird set of circumstances to catch up on it. Yeah, and you can find the first five seasons are on Netflix if you're in the US, and the sixth is still in progress, and you can find it on demand.
Eugene Levy is the guy behind, I think, Best in Show and a couple of other, Waiting for Guffman, a couple of other movies that apparently are very much ad-libbed. Is this show very much ad-libbed?
I don't think so. I think it's the creation of Eugene Levy, but also his son Daniel, who plays his son on the show. And I think it's just really brilliantly written. A lot of times, the best people writing comedy can make it seem like they're it's kind of spontaneous. I think you're right that those ones like Waiting for Guffman, that whole Christopher Guest kind of troupe, a lot of those are a little bit more improvised, I think.
So Jonathan on Twitter is writing about a show I wanted to talk about anyway, Tiger King. He says, this show has everything. Polyamory, murder for hire, YouTube stars, bad singing, everyone is truly awful, but you can't look away. And Alyssa, you put this on your list, this Tiger King show. I made myself watch the first episode last night. I'm sold.
Yeah, I mean, so I should preface this by saying I don't think it's a good show at all.
It's not, no.
it's very much like gawk at the train wreck. And there's episode three in particular, which is, I'm not going to spoil it, but it's the one everyone's talking about, I think is just kind of ethically heinous. But it also dropped the same weekend that most people were going into self-isolation situations. And it is almost perfect distraction material. It's so strange. It's so weird. Every time you think it's gotten as weird as it can go, it gets weirder. And it has, you know, true crime elements. It has sort of like expedition into the strange worlds of people you've never heard of elements. And it has a guy who runs for president with a mullet, who's a country singer, whose songs are on YouTube. And it has tigers, like actual big tigers. So, yeah, I think it's a good example of the kind of thing that people really want to bond over when they're all isolated in their houses. At least you can get on Twitter or Facebook or something and post about Tiger King, and a whole bunch of other people will have done the same thing at the same time. But I just want to make it clear that there's a lot about it that I find a little bit, you know, yeah, ethically, I guess, murky. But at the same time, like, it's absolutely compulsively watchable.
Yeah, and in the first episode, it pits this guy, the Tiger King, who is raising tigers and exhibiting them in very close settings. People can come and pet them and do all that kind of stuff, against this animal rights activist who also is rescuing tigers. And both of these people put tigers in cages. So I'm not sure who's the good guy and who's the bad guy here. And I think that's what you're supposed to think in episode one. I guess maybe they'll reveal that as we go forward. There are a lot of other TV shows, but let me move to movies for just a couple of minutes here, because some of the movies that you can now get on streaming include, Sean, Birds of Prey, which is from the DC Comics universe, Ben Affleck's The Way Back, Elizabeth Moss, who was on The Handmaid's Tale and Mad Men, is in The Invisible Man. And then there's Pixar's Onward and The Hunt. You're recommending all of these?
It's not that I'm necessarily recommending all of them. I'm just bringing awareness to the fact that these movies are available on streaming services, or like an iTunes or Fandango Now or something. Because I don't think people have paid attention to the fact that these have jumped from theaters to become, like, normally that window is several months long.
Right.
It has shrunk. And so if you thought you wanted to see Invisible Man, which that's one of the ones I definitely would say to check out, get the whole family together and sort of watch it. They're at a steeper price than you would have assumed, but if you were paying movie theater tickets for everybody to go, it's worth the rental. I think the price point now is $19.99, somewhere in that $20 range for a rental, and I think you get a 48-hour window. Some of the studios are giving you a 48-hour rental. Others are giving you the ability to own it digitally just with the purchase. I think Warner Brothers is doing that for Birds of Prey and The Way Back. The Way Back is one of those films where I heard from a lot of people saying, oh, I kind of wanted to check that out, but I just wasn't going to get to the theater to see it. That's worth seeing. Gavin O'Connor's a good director who makes these sports movies that aren't really about sports. And this is a basketball movie about an alcoholic coach who's trying to find his way back. And Ben Affleck has a lot of personal demons that speak to that character. So I would definitely recommend that. And then Onward, it was a weird Pixar film. It didn't necessarily appeal to families. They didn't rush out to see it, but I want to let people know that it's available for streaming now. It's going to be on Disney Plus, and I know families are chomping at the bit for fresh entertainment for their kids.
And Linda, you also mentioned The Invisible Man. You mentioned Emma and Spellbound as films that you're enjoying, and you say, if I'm not misunderstanding you, they are streaming free on Tubi?
Well, Spellbound is. Tubi is a free with commercials streaming service. So it works a lot like all of these other services that we're talking about, except that you'll see commercials. So even if you're watching a movie, like if you were watching a movie on like a broadcast channel, it'll have commercial breaks in it, which is kind of unsettling and weird, but it's free. And I also want to shout out, there's a beautiful, really, really beautiful French romance called Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is on Hulu. Really one of my favorite movies in a long time, incredibly beautiful. And again, available on Hulu now.
And Alyssa, you wrote a column for Vox called The 10 Best Movies You Can Now Watch at Home. They're all in different genres, and they were all produced outside the big budget studio system. One is a crudely drawn 2012 cult classic by Don Hertzfeldt, called It's Such a Beautiful Day. It's an existential journey in 1 hour, is how it's described.
Yeah. If you know Don Hertzfeldt's work, then you are a fan, usually. He does mainly these kind of stick figure things. He made a couple of short films called World of Tomorrow the past couple years. But this one is a story about a stick figure named Bill whose life kind of starts imploding, and it's about an hour long. It's one of the weirdest things you could possibly watch, and it's just, if that like appeals to you, that's the kind of movie that you might want to see. Herzfeld is also known for having done one of the weirdest couch gags that The Simpsons ever had. That if you look it up, it kind of makes you feel like you're going crazy watching it. But yeah, you can watch it on Vimeo. Usually you can rent it, but Don made it free once the virus kind of hit and people ended up in their houses.
And you have another on your list. It's a Netflix movie called Crip Camp. And this, the subtitle is A Disability Revolution. This is about a summer camp run by hippies for handicapable people before they were considered as such. It really looks intriguing. I watched the trailer yesterday.
Yeah, it's terrific. It's co-directed by two documentarians, one of whom was a camper at the camp in the 70s, and a lot of the campers became activists as young adults in the disability rights movement, and really got a lot of laws changed and things changed in the U.S. This also is the second film on the Obama's Netflix slate, and so they sort of saw it and grabbed it because it fits so well with ideas about activism and how communities can come together to really affect change. It's also inspirational and really funny. So it's a good watch for whole family, I think, but it's also just kind of inspirational about like the fact that normal people doing things together can actually change things in government or in the world that they want to see changed. So I really, really enjoyed it. It opened the Sundance Film Festival this year, and it won audience awards there, which means everyone who saw it there really loved it too. So yeah, streaming on Netflix now, and I think it's really, really worth a watch.
I know this is about this show is about television and movies that you can get at home while you're stuck at home. But Linda, on a recent edition of your Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, you recommended some books to make your isolation feel a little less lonely.
Absolutely, I read. We recommended a bunch of books. I recommended two. One is a kind of a contemporary romantic comedy called The Hating Game. And the other is the gigantic, wonderfully entertaining book, The Miss Manners Guide to Excruciatingly Correct Behavior. if you've ever read Miss Manners, Judith Martin, she's a wonderful, funny, just wise, really, it's manners, but not in terms of like which fork, but in terms of how do you treat people. She's a very wise and wonderfully funny writer. And I think it's called Miss Manners Guide to Excruciatingly Correct Behavior. It's a big fat book. I love that one. And you can get it digitally or in hard copy from your favorite bookstore, which will happily ship it to you.
Another TV show that you recommend is on BBC One. I guess that means BBC America in this country. I don't know. It's called The Repair Shop, and it sounds a little bit to me like Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah, The Repair Shop actually for in the U.S., you want to watch that one also on Netflix. It was originally a BBC show. People bring their beloved antique and old items to this place where there are a bunch of artisans who do fine repair work on things like stained glass and old dolls and teddy bears and things like that. So there's always a sentimental story, but also craftspeople doing work. If you like the kind of the vibe of the Great British Bake Off, but you don't care that much about cookies, this is kind of maybe a way to get that soothing vibe.
And Alyssa, I have 15 seconds. And one of the comedies that you mentioned on television is also being mentioned by a number of people who have been emailing in, High Maintenance. It's about a New York cannabis dealer who goes around New York on a bicycle, right?
Mm-hmm. Little peeks into people's lives. It's wonderful. Yeah.
Slice of life. Although that slice of life is probably, he's probably out of a job right now, given what we're going through.
I don't know.
Alyssa Wilkinson, film critic for Vox, Linda Holmes, pop culture correspondent for NPR, and Sean O'Connell, managing director of Cinema Blend and co-host of the Real Blend podcast. Thank you all for the hour.
Cut. That's a wrap.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com.